Hear you.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Tuesday, November 5th, 2024. This is the second case on our calendar for oral argument this morning. It is the matter of Terry Colton et al. Versus Gary Mimkin et al. Counsel, you will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellants, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and the time is indicated in one of the tiles on your screen if you're using gallery view. It's important when you begin your argument that you state your name and identify the party you represent because we are making an audio recording of this hearing. That is the only recording that is permitted. And with that, counsel for appellants, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Matthew Francis, Wheaton, Minnesota, here on behalf of the appellants Terry Colton and Brenda Burton, here to argue their case. This issue before Your Honors is very simple. It's whether or not the mediated settlement agreement entered into between the parties is ambiguous, specifically because the parties did not define a crucial term, that term being the word structure. Each party, as the court can see from the pleadings filed by each party below, as well as the arguments made in my brief, show very clearly that the parties did not have an understanding, a mutual meeting of the mind as to what the word structure meant. And therefore, based upon that, the mediated settlement agreement is by definition an ambiguous ambiguous agreement and therefore cannot stand. And this court should overrule the district court and remand the matter back down below and for further proceedings. We make this argument for very simple reasons. Number one, the term structure, the whole purpose of this lawsuit was based upon the appellants wanting filing an adverse possession action in part because they wanted to continue to place recreational seasonal items, and we defined it as campers, trailers, RVs, and the like, onto property that was owned by the respondents. Throughout the course of the litigation, that is what part of the very strong term that was for the appellants. And when they came to a final agreement, the agreement, as they could see in the mediated settlement agreement, was that there was not supposed to be any new structures placed on there. And they used, as an example, RVs or a water spigot. Now, water spigot is a below ground item. It's by its very nature is a permanent in nature or a permanent structure because it is there year round. And it's not going to be moved. The appellant's understanding of the term structure would also apply to any above ground structures that were also permanent in nature. When he used the term RV, they interpreted that to mean a year-round RV or a year-round structure. The appellants do not have any items that are on that parcel, we call it the transferred parcel in the litigation, that are year-round. They are merely seasonal. They're there for at least 3 months out of the year. It may extend into May into September as well. But these are
Mr. Francis, what language can you direct me to in the agreement that ties whether something is a structure to its permanency or its permanent placement all year round on the transferred parcel?
It's not there, Your Honor. That's kind of exactly our argument. It's not defined as to what structure is. It's not defined at
but,
all.
But if what you're telling me is this case is really about campers, trailers, RVs, doesn't inclusion as an example of what a structure is, an RV, suggest that those are covered as structures?
When you are pairing it with the word utilities that it exit from the ground, and when I'm looking off the screen, I have another computer screen to my right. So if you see me looking over, that is what I'm looking at. When you're pairing it with a utilities that exit from the ground and their respective replacements, that by its very definition implies that what you're talking about is a permanent structure. After all, if you had a temporary structure, what would it matter that was there from year to year? What would it matter if it was going to be replaced? For example, if I have a 1990 style camper and I want to upgrade and I get a 2000 style camper, why would it matter that I have to denote that or have a specific term saying that it's going to be replaced? We're talking about a camper. It would only make sense if that were to be a year-round object that were going to be replaced and that the parties then would understand, hey, I'm getting a new model, I'm getting an upgrade, I'm getting something different, and that's going to replace what is already there.
Is there a genuine dispute about whether RVs would be covered by this mediated settlement?
Yes, because as we all know, RVs can be placed on places year-round. And in this instance, because the parties were operating on a seasonal, at least my clients were operating or using these structures or the campers and RVs on a seasonal basis, they interpreted that language as to mean nothing permanent unless it was already there on a permanent basis. After all, this is the main part of their litigation. Why would they negotiate away the very heart of their litigation, which was to make sure that they could continue to use this area for their temporary seasonal items?
Wasn't the heart of their litigation to become the owner of the transferred parcel, which
initially,
they
yes.
Achieved? And so the easement is the respondent's easement, right? And so, I mean, I'm confused as to what this is. I mean, if the purpose of this, of 2B2, it strikes me, is to make sure that respondents can actually traverse the transferred parcel, that mm-hmm. there aren't going to be so many structures, whether they're campers or RVs or water spigots, that prevent access or use of that to get to the lake. Am I wrong about that, or what am I missing?
I think, Your Honor, I don't think you're incorrect on that, Your Honor, but I think the issue still is if it's going to be temporary or not. And that is the heart of what is going to be temporary and what is going to be permanent. I think that the agreement was only looking to be what was permanent. Again, this agreement was on August 11th. Okay. I believe it was in one of the affidavit of attorney Brandborg that most of the stuff had been, oh, I don't know if actually I shouldn't say that. I don't know what was there and what wasn't there on August 11th, but let's just say for the sake of argument that there were other things that were not there that had already been removed. That would mean that anything that wasn't there, they couldn't go back and place it there. They had a very
August 11th would be a time of the year where seasonal items would still be there, wouldn't it?
Some could, some may not, Your Honor. I don't know exactly what was there and what wasn't there the date of. Go ahead, Your Honor.
I have a question about your request for relief in comparison or vis-a-vis what the district court ordered. So I think I'm looking now at the last page of the district court's order. It's at addendum 14. I think it's interesting in the top paragraph on that page that the district court ordered the parties to take further action, including work with each other to identify the number and exact location of any above ground structures as of the mediation date. If the parties cannot agree, they may submit the matter to the court for a decision. So it seems to me the district courts, I mean, sometimes, speaking generally now, sometimes with motions to enforce settlement agreements, the district court's order is, it means exactly what the movement says, or on the other hand, it doesn't. It means what the non-movement says. It's finally resolved, in one party's favor or another. This seems more nuanced. It seems like the district court has a process going forward to resolve the issues that it seems to me are being discussed in your brief. So, I guess my question or questions is, what's wrong with that? How is what you're asking us to do different from what the district court ordered? And why not just let that process play out and then see where you end up before asking the Court of Appeals for a resolution?
Because that paragraph, Your Honor, presupposes that there are items that each party agreed were there on August 11th. And I don't know what was there, what wasn't there. I wasn't the attorney of record at the district court level. It's not part of the record what objects were there or not supposed to be there, going back to Judge Klopotke's.
Is there a legitimate disagreement about what items were there?
I don't know that the answer to that question, Your Honor. And it's not, like I said, it's not part of the record, but I think it goes back to, my understanding is that there are items that were removed prior to August 11th, and that was another reason or basis for my client saying, look, this is not what we agreed to. There are things that aren't there that would we be stuck with what was there and exactly on August 11th. And that was not our intent of our agreement. Our intent was only what was going to be there year round, not what was going to be there on a temporary basis. And I think there was also an issue of going back to even to Judge Bjorkman's question earlier about getting access through that is that these items aren't necessarily located at the same place every year. And so that's another issue here, from my understanding, that's, again, not part of the record, but that the parties did not intend on being tied in to where they had to put each item of their season recreational vehicles or objects every single year. So, and I think another issue to this is to, or another piece of evidence, I should say, is to the fact that this being ambiguous is the fact that the district court tried its best to define it for both parties. Well, as soon as you're trying to impose what the district court, a third party to the mediated settlement agreement, what it believed to be a definition of structures, that by its very nature, again, is ambiguous or makes the whole thing ambiguous, because that definition certainly wasn't the appellant's understanding. And quite frankly, I don't know if that would necessarily be the respondent's understanding, because when you look at the statutes that the district court cited, all three of those, quite frankly, I don't think they apply. The first one that the court cited was to a tax statute that defined structures in its very definition, defined them as objects affixed to the land. Well, that would only apply if that was in favor of the appellant's version or interpretation of the word structures, meant that it was something that was affixed to the land there on a yearly basis, like a water spigot. The second one dealing with, I forget exactly what the statute is, but or what it, the context is, but 116G03, subdivision 11, it defines a structure as housing, business, commercial, agriculture, or office purposes. Well, again, that wouldn't apply to any of the objects in this instance. And then 363.013, subdivision 60, defines a structure as any object constructed or installed, including that limitation to buildings, towers, smokestacks, and overhead transmission lines. Well, again, that is not anything close to what we're talking about in this case. So while the district court tried to resolve the dispute in a sense, I think it thought that it was making a common sense definition or providing a common sense definition, but those definitions don't apply. And again, by their very nature, demonstrate that this is an ambiguous contract between the parties, and therefore we don't have a meeting of the minds and we don't have an agreement here that should be
Did your
enforced.
clients, before signing this agreement, make these similar objections?
I cannot speak to that specifically, Your Honor. I would presume that, again, that when the parties were meeting, that what was told to them was that this did not apply to their seasonal recreational vehicles and only applied to year-round objects. Because that, again, my reading and looking at this is that's what they were trying to do in order for everybody to know what was going to be there on a permanent basis, not on a seasonal basis.
Mr. Francis, you just made reference to your argument that there was no meeting of the minds. You also briefed that issue. To me, is that an alternative argument? Is that an argument that would result in different relief for you?
Well, I think, Your Honor, when I asked for the relief, I based that based upon the Supreme Court's decision in the VoiceStream case from 2008. And in it, it said that as a general rule, the enforcement of a settlement agreement requires a hearing if the issues are sharply conflicting and there are questions of fact for a fact finder to decide. Now, perhaps maybe in this case, we can say there really isn't a fact issues of fact for the fact finder to define, but this is the only case that I really saw what to do other than to throw this matter to trial. My clients are perfectly happy to have this case be remanded back to district court for trial on the merits. But like I said, because I have a Supreme Court decision that might apply, I have a duty to tell the court that this appears to be an alternate or an option, not an option, but what we're supposed to be doing. But if your honors were to feel that that's not the proper remedy, I'm not going to object. We think that we just want this matter to go back and be heard, either whether it's a trial on the merits or it's an issue of what does each party understand that term to mean.
Well, it seems like some of your arguments could result, if you were successful, could result in an order that compels a deed that has your wording. It also
Right.
seems like some of your arguments could lead the district court to say there was no agreement, so I'm going to deny completely the motion to enforce the settlement agreement. And we all just go back to, the place that you were before the settlement
Right.
conference, before the mediation conference. And I'm confused about which one. You seem to be seeking both, but in the conclusion of your brief on page 22, you want a remand back for an evidentiary hearing to determine what may be placed in the transferred parcel. But that argument assumes that there will be an order resolving this case based on the settlement agreement, not based on the merits.
Right.
Yeah. But are you making a layered argument with an alternative? And if so, which is your primary and which is your secondary?
Well, Your Honor, based upon the court's questioning here, I think the primary relief that my clients would like to see would be a trial on the merits. have this matter. But I, like I said, I put in there about just an evidentiary hearing, and if, as the court indicated, kind of a layered argument because of the Supreme Court case, which may or may not apply. It may be something that the that based upon the.
So, in other words, your preference is a determination. There was no meeting of the minds. There was no valid agreement.
Right.
And so on. And so what, and what case law, what's your best case law for that, resolution?
I would, as far as that, it should be just sent back to the district court. I, in front of me, Your Honor, with a minute left, or actually 16 seconds left, I don't know if I could find that in time, but it'd be just one of the cases that I had cited in the brief indicating that there was just not a, there's not been a meeting of the minds, and therefore, there's not a valid contract between the parties. And then what happens after that is, I presume it would be a, the case would be remanded back to district court for a trial. In this case, like I said, the VoiceStream case, the second sentence after what I had read previously said, trial courts have the inherent power to summarily enforce a settlement agreement as a matter of law when the terms of the agreement are clear and unambiguous. But if the material facts are disputed, then an evidentiary hearing is required. So this is now whether this is, I got confused by saying this is what we're arguing over is a material fact, the definition of what the term structure means, or if it's not a material fact, it's a question of law as to what it meant. And it's an ambiguous term, and therefore it's not a question of fact. It's a interpretation of what something means, and therefore it's ambiguous. Therefore, we don't have a contract. Therefore, we go back to trial since the mediation failed. And I think that's probably maybe in arguing this case out with Your Honor, I think that is the best course to go through.
I appreciate that. If Judge Bjorkman would allow, I've got one more question to wrap up this subject, if I may. And that is, you know, so the VoiceStream type hearing that you just mentioned, how is that different from what the district court provided for on page 14 of its order, where the district court says, if they cannot agree, they may submit the matter to the court for a decision?
Right. Because the what the district court had ordered, Your Honor, was what is there on August 11, 2022. So in other words, it was
saying— But doesn't that implicate the definition of structure? I mean, basically that, I mean, that, the question identified by the district court, isn't it, you know, the same question that you're focused on appeal?
No, Your Honor. The district court had indicated in its order that it was including into the word structure the RVs, campers, the season recreational items that my clients are saying was not part of that word. And therefore, it was saying, OK, since I've defined the word structure, since it is going to include all these things, then I want to know if you guys don't agree as to what was there on August 11th, you can come back to me and we can have an evidentiary hearing as to what was there, what wasn't there. I'm saying that the, since that those were those items were not part of the word structure, should not be termed the word structure, going back for a an evidentiary hearing is about what can be placed there, what can't be placed there on the
Thank
merits.
You. Thank,
Thank
you,
Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondents, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Robert Russell, and I'm here on behalf of Gary and Teresa Minkin, the respondents in this matter. Appellants assert the record before the court supports a determination that they believe the term structure in the settlement agreement prohibited permanent structures and did not apply to movable structures, contrary to what the respondents understood, and thus they claim an ambiguity exists that necessitates a reversal of the trial court's decision. Appellant's argument, however, on ambiguity is fatal for two reasons, at least two reasons. One, it's contrary to the plain language of the mediated settlement agreement. The word permanent, interestingly, is used in two places, but only to describe the nature of the easements being granted my clients. So the word permanent was not unknown to plaintiffs when they, through two attorneys, negotiated the MSA, but it was not used to modify structure. Now, appellants in their reply brief said they should have inserted the word movable, but it's clear it was intended to apply to both movable and permanent structures because in two places it said RVs and utilities. One is movable, one is not. And the argument here that they were being moved That's why the language says in their exact location as of the date of the mediation agreement. Exact location. And it also says in placements that do not further encroach. This argument that replacements could only refer to permanent structures is nonsensical. It's clear that replacements would refer to structures that are movable. Those are the type that are constantly being changed for whatever reason or taken off the property. So the intent is clear that this was intended to apply to both permanent and movable structures. Now,
do structures include things like trailers or campers?
Yes. Yes. That's why we said it.
Well, what authority? I know the district court cited various statutes, but are there dictionary or other definitions that would support your argument that structure is broad enough to include things like trailers and campers?
It was used to be the broadest term possible when we were trying to make sure, because we knew that the use of this property was for movable objects, and we wanted. And movable objects can be many things. It can be a boat. It could be a trailer. It could be a variety of things. And so a structure implies a physical, a man-made improvement. And that's what these are. And that is clear by the fact that we say they have to be in their exact location and their respective replacements that do not further encroach. That's the language in paragraph 2b2. There would be no reason to include those references if you were only referring to permanent structures, because permanent structures would stay in the same place, and permanent structures are not likely to move their location. Plus, I think it's very important for the court to remember there is no evidence of the appellant's intentions. We are only taking it on the words stated in the brief. The record is entirely absent or lacking any proof of the appellant's intentions. The only reference to the appellant's intentions was in an affidavit by Penn Brandborg, one of their attorneys, where he stated in his document that their intent was never to change their continued use. And we agree with that. We weren't trying to change the continued use. My clients were simply trying to say, as of this date, that's going to be it. Nothing new, nothing more, no change in the footprint.
Mr. Russell, do you have evidence of your client's intents?
Yes, we have the affidavits. We have the affidavit of Gary Meepkin. We have the affidavits that included emails, but most importantly, we have the language of the MSA itself. Why would he negotiate only permanent when this major use of this property was for movable objects? Why would he insist on their exact location if he was worried about permanent objects? Why would he insist upon that do not further encroach if he was worried about further objects? So the intention is in the language of the document and the affidavits. I believe there was both an original affidavit of Gary Meepkin and a supplemental affidavit of Gary Meepkin.
Mr. Russell, on a different issue, your opposing counsel said that the district court determined that the types of items at issue are within the definition of structure. Do you agree with that? I see on page 11 of the district court's order, the district court provides definitions, but I'm wondering whether the district court applied those definitions to the things in this case, such as a tent or a trailer. Did the district court make any final determination of whether such things are within the definition of structure?
I think it did implicitly, but I don't think the definitions it looked to are relevant, because I think the document as a whole speaks for itself to make it clear that structure applied to both movable and permanent. And in fact, a clear indication of that is one of the attorneys who negotiated the mediated settlement agreement, Penn Brandborg, swears out an affidavit where he refers to structure in a sentence that includes tents, travel trailers, and RVs within the category of structure. So he too left that day knowing that these were movable objects. He used the term in his affidavit. Yet they're now trying to disown what was negotiated and what was clear, I believe, in the mediated settlement agreement. Did Judge Judd make clear that whether or not a tent would qualify? I believe by his ruling, it does qualify. And that is implicit in the terms of the document and reflects the intent of the parties.
But it's not an express determination by the district court, it sounds.
No, like. there's no language that I recall where he says tents are included in structures. But as opposed to a natural improvement, structures embraces anything man-made. I'd like to also briefly comment on the notion here that they have brought a motion to amend findings, when in truth, it was a motion for reconsideration. Now, both sides have cited Lewis and the progeny of cases that came after, but Lewis still stands for the proposition that you have to give a reason why you want amended findings. And there was no reason given why for the amended findings, either in any of the briefing or in the oral argument. And in fact, Judge Judd argued at the December 18th hearing, or asked this question: do you know why I'm being asked to, I guess, amend all of these things? It is just tell me what the language council wants. You tell me what the language council wants me to do, but it gives me no guidance, no case law, nothing as to the reason why. Why? And there was no why. And I would say this motion was improper under the rules of procedure, because it did not give a why. And Lewis has been cited by the Court of Appeals in a published case that was cited in my brief, and by at least two unpublished cases, as well as two tax court unpublished cases, that you still have to give a why. They didn't give a why. Their motion was not proper. The two points that the court made in the decision in Stern 1011, then it must comply with the rules of civil procedure. It did not comply. I would include the district court rules, which require a memorandum for substantive motions, and it must be authorized, meaning the party has filed a motion that is expressly allowed under Rule 104.01, which includes a motion for amended findings. But that is prefaced in the rule by is proper and timely. And the court has made it clear in the precedent that's been established that proper includes a written submission saying why. They didn't give it in writing. They did not give it at the hearing. They have failed to do that. And as a result, they're really trying to appeal from an order that was entered a long time ago, and the appeal period has expired. I also want to go to the standard of a review for a moment, if I may. I quite frankly have some confusion, because in the Johnson versus St. Paul Insurance Company case I cited in my brief, the court says a motion to enforce a settlement agreement, a decision in that is for an abuse of discretion. There's the well-known case of Dykes versus Suckup that says whether a contract is ambiguous is a question of law that is considered de novo. But then it's also been stated that a district court's decision on amended findings is subject to an abuse of discretion review. I believe that whether it's abuse of discretion or de novo review, that in this case, what is before the court and what is in the MSA, by all of the language used in the attendant language to that I have specifically referred to, makes it clear that both movable and unmovable objects were included. The Supreme Court said in Hartung versus Spielmeyer, a 1954 Minnesota Supreme Court case, If the court can reasonably find the party's intent by applying the words that the parties must have understood them. The parties understood they were talking about movable objects on the date they mediated. That was what the issue was. And there was going to be fee simple title transferred to the appellant in exchange for, in effect, a scenic easement that limited the number of trailer units that could be placed on the property to what was there that day at their exact location. I can tell the court that after all of this, we did exchange maps. They're proposing it was 7 or 8 RVs in certain locations. We only had a dispute as to the location of one of those RVs, which has been moved closer to what we considered the boundary line. That happened between myself and Mr. Brandberg and Mr. Anderson before Mr. Francis got involved. But there was a clear understanding we were looking at movable objects. And for the parties, the appellants, to come before you now and claim they didn't understand that, when all they were worried about was movable objects, and all we were worried about was movable objects, and that was clear during the course of the mediated settlement agreement, and clear by the use of both RVs to describe movable and utilities to describe structure. Mr. Francine said,
Can I ask you this? It seems like we might be getting a little bit astray from what is in the record before us. I just want to make sure I understand then that your position vis-a-vis paragraph 3, I mean, there was no new survey that was done that identified the location of the movable and permanent, all structures, as you interpret the agreement to require. There was no survey that was done by August 12th, 2022, correct?
Correct.
Okay, but if I understand what you're arguing, you're not taking the position that the failure to have the survey completed by that date means that appellants can no longer place any structures on the transferred parcel, are you?
No, I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing that, and as I think what the court made clear in the suck-up case is that if there's an ambiguity determined, it's remand to consider parole evidence. At worst, there should be a remand to consider parole evidence as to what structure meant. But no, we're not arguing they can't put them in the same place. All we're arguing about is what structures were there on that date and where they were located. That's simply all we're arguing. I did reference in one oral argument that maybe we could argue an estoppel since they didn't get the survey as they were supposed to, but we've never advanced that argument. It was a reference that probably was inappropriately made that has no bearing to what we are seeking in this matter. What we are seeking is a determination that based on the four corners of the document, this court can discern the intent of the parties on the record before it, and that intent was to cover both movable and permanent structures, and that what the court ordered is sufficient. The parties are going to work out what should be surveyed and where, and if they can't work out, it comes back to the court, and the court will take testimony to decide what should have been accomplished through a survey. We are asking for the court to affirm the lower court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Francis, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start out with when counsel is talking about what the parties did and didn't agree to. As part of the record, is it cited at addendum page 40, is an email from opposing counsel to Mr. Brandberg, where he specifically says, I also do not understand the need for line 2 as the agreement, again, referring to the mediated settlement agreement, was no permanent structures in the land to be conveyed except as presently exist. So at one time, it was very clear that even opposing counsel agreed with our position that this whole point of what constituted a structure was not anything that was a permanent structure. It was only supposed to be their seasonal recreational items that I've been arguing is what the party's intent was all along. For some reason, that changed as the parties continued to try to negotiate and get into a final settlement on this matter. With respect to other things that counsel said, with respect to what Mr. Brandberg put in his affidavit, that's found at addendum page 30, Here he clearly states in paragraph 10, as noted above, there are not outside of water spigots and a water drain any permanent structures on a transfer parcel. During the summer, the transfer parcel, along with the northerly boundary of plaintiff's properties, filled with campers, tents, trailers, travel trailers, and RVs, which are then removed after camping season. The intent was never to give up the current use of the contested property. The qualifying phrase, permanent structures nowhere to be found, so on, et cetera. So it's very clear that it's always been our position that we're not, this is not the what the intent of the agreement was. And then with respect to, I'm trying to look at my notes from counsel's arguments. And then when he talks about the word, the use of the word encroachment, you know, if you look at the context of a whole paragraph, which is found on the bottom of the first page of the mediated settlement agreement, paragraph 2B2, it says, you know, prohibits any, that their agreement was supposed to prohibit any new above ground structures on the transfer parcel, but permits any above ground structures currently existing and their at their current exact location, such as RV utilities exit from the ground, and the respective replacements that do not further encroach. So basically, that do not further encroach is only about the replacements, and that meant nothing who gets replaced gets moved any further. That's all that meant. It had nothing to do with the issue of what defined a structure or didn't define a structure. And then finally, Your Honors, I think just, you know, Mr. Russell brings up this issue of the timely filed appeal. I think the law, as I cited in my brief, is very, very clear on this. The Supreme Court make it very, very clear. The test is whether on its face, this is the Madsen decision, the test is whether on the face of the document that the party has filed, the motion is expressly allowed under Rule 104.01 of the Rules of Civil Appellate Procedure. And the Supreme Court further clarified this in Stern 1011 First State South case, where it stated the purpose of the amendments to Rule 104.01 was twofold. One, to make it clear that an appeal is not necessary till the proper motion is decided, and to avoid, secondly, to avoid erroneous assumption and improper and unauthorized motion would prevent the running of an appeal deadline. So even if the first, as a district court found that my appeal that was filed, which I drafted, that was, did not meet a, the proper, motion for amended findings, that's irrelevant. What's irrelevant is what is on the face of the document. When you look at the face of the motion, it specifically says that it's labeled as a motion to amend the findings of fact. And every paragraph, except for the first paragraph and the last paragraph, specifically pointed to a paragraph of the district court's order that I believed or we wanted the district court to amend, and specifically suggested the amended language we wanted the new order to read. We did not allege new facts or proffer a new legal theory like you're supposed to under a motion for reconsideration. The whole point of that, of doing it in that way, was to argue from the record. As noted in my brief, the attorney who I've been consulting with was Justin Anderson. He was the one who was supposed to make the oral argument from the record. At the last minute, he handed it off to attorney Brandborg, who, by his own admission, and cited in the transcript, cited in my brief, wasn't prepared for the hearing and it was not able to effectively argue the case. So at its face, pursuant to the Madsen decision, I made a proper motion that told the time, that told the time for appeal. There should not be any argument about that. And unless anybody has any further questions, I don't want to, well, I'm out of time anyway, but I didn't want to repeat myself. So thank you, Your Honors, very much.
Thank you, counsel. I don't see my colleagues having an additional questions. So we will take this matter under advisement. I thank you both for your helpful arguments, and we will issue a decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.